morning, Coleman versus Ramos.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. To my knowledge, this is the first opportunity that this Court has had to address the actual innocence claim under House v. Bell as a substitute, a procedural gateway to have his substantive claims heard under habeas. Petitioner acknowledges that it is a difficult showing under House v. Bell, but we firmly believe that he has met that showing. I'd like to begin by talking really about the first piece of evidence that indicates that Maurice Coleman was not involved in the murder in this case, and that is the testimony and the affidavit of the accomplice, Joseph Barnes, who provided both an affidavit and a testimony in the post-conviction proceeding in which he stated that Maurice Coleman was not the individual who was involved in the home invasion and in the murder of Terrell Jackson.
Well, in his affidavit, Mr. Barnes claimed that he and Roy Wright committed the crime. But then at the post-conviction hearing, Barnes claimed that a third party, Bennett Hall, was present at Jackson's house and shot. Which version of Barnes' story should be credited?
Well, I think that you could credit either of the versions because both of them eliminate Maurice Coleman as the person who was involved in the murder. It is true that he has given a different indication as to exactly how this murder occurred. It's also true that when he was fighting extradition, he said he wasn't involved at all. I think a jury confronted with the facts of the circumstances under which he made that initial statement when he was facing the death penalty and when he was trying to avoid first being found guilty of this crime and secondly avoid being executed for this crime, that his statement that he wasn't involved is understandable. Now, significantly, with respect to Maurice Coleman's involvement, he's given only three occasions he's given statements. The two are the two that Your Honor has described, but significantly probative from our view is the first statement that he gave, which he gave in confidence to his trial attorney, and he gave that statement at a time in which he did not even know whether Maurice Coleman would be convicted of this crime. And he wasn't trying to curry Maurice Coleman's favor or anybody else's favor. And his version that Maurice Coleman was not involved was backed up by the affidavit and testimony of his then trial attorney, now a Circuit Court County judge, James Rhodes. He testified that Joseph Barnes said that Maurice Coleman was not involved in this murder, and he felt bad that he might be found guilty of this crime. I think that provides significant and compelling evidence that corroborates the later statements of Joseph Barnes that Maurice Coleman was not involved. Now, if that were the entirety of the evidence in this case, I believe that a reasonable jury might discount that testimony is not sufficient. But what we know, Your Honors, is that there was additional evidence of Maurice Coleman's non-involvement. And significantly, it was the Wilkins brothers' testimony that Maurice Coleman was not the individual who was outside of the home on the afternoon of the murder and was not one of the two individuals who had walked to the laundromat. Their testimony also strongly supports that Maurice Coleman was not the person who perpetrated this crime. As Your Honors know, that is one of the claimed errors that we make with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And so, to some extent, the actual innocence argument and the ineffective assistance claims, they run together. Those witnesses were not called by trial counsel at Maurice Coleman's trial. At the time, as Your Honors are aware, his attorney, his trial attorney, submitted a statement to the judge under seal, so the judge never actually saw the contents of it, in which both he and his co-counsel, that is, counsel for Mr. Barnes, both stated that they had interviewed these two witnesses, David and Tracy Wilkins, and that they were prepared to testify that Joseph Barnes was involved in this crime, but that Maurice Coleman was not the individual who they saw on the porch. It is completely inexplicable to me, and the record does not reveal any reason why those witnesses were not called as witnesses at the trial.
What would have happened, though, because they're incompatible with his co-defendant's position, right?
Those two witnesses, the Wilkins brothers, would have obviously damaged Mr. Barnes's case, and as they both would have said, he was involved in the home invasion. But that was not a constitutional or a concern, a Sixth Amendment concern, of Mr. Coleman's attorney. Mr. Coleman was entitled to the undivided loyalty of his own counsel and his own counsel's effort to bring forth that powerfully exculpatory testimony by independent witnesses, witnesses who did not know the victims, who did not know Mr. Coleman, did not know Mr. Barnes. And he owed his duty of loyalty to secure that testimony and have that brought. Undoubtedly, it hurt his co-defendant's counsel. I think that's why he sought a severance. But, of course, he could have told the judge the reason for the severance is that these two witnesses are going to exonerate my client and fully inculpate the co-defendant.
Well, he did try to do it in other ways with the in-camera hearing.
He did, Your Honor, in the sense that he did put it. He first asked for an in-camera hearing, and he asked that it be done ex parte, and the trial judge refused. But once the trial judge refused, it is our position that he had the obligation to go forward with that testimony, even at a joint trial, even when it would have hurt his co-defendant's case, exclusively because he had no duty of loyalty to the co-defendant. And ultimately, it would have been the co-defendant's counsel's obligation to try to secure a severance. And perhaps, had that evidence come out, the trial judge would have then known now what the problem was and had either granted a mistrial or granted a severance. We don't know what would have happened. But one thing we do know is when you don't give a judge a reason for granting separate trials, you're not going to get separate trials. So it may have put that in the record, but it didn't. It had no impact on the court because the court had no reason to grant a severance, not having been given any reason. And in fact, as far as we know, the trial court never, ever learned what the reason was because the matter was placed under seal.
Get back to that. I mean, it's like the chicken and the egg because he was given an opportunity to know, but he didn't want to follow that procedure of an ex parte communication.
That's correct. And obviously, maybe the judge was right or wrong about that. That, unfortunately, is not the issue, obviously, before this court today.
Of course, and then it could have been played out that if he did call the witness, then the other opposing counsel would have objected because of the implication. And so there would have been a sidebar, like you were saying, it would have had to have come out unless the co-counsel was asleep at the switch.
Yes, absolutely. And so the issue would have been. And quite frankly, the state knew that, at least with respect to David Wilkins, because he had viewed the lineup in that the same lineup that the two victim witnesses testified.
Did they file joint motion? He and the co-counsel filed a joint motion?
They both sought a severance under a mutually antagonistic theory. Now, Mr. Cole, that is the petitioner's counsel, also sought a severance several times, trying, I think, to raise whatever argument he could to secure this severance. But the trial judge did not grant it, and so it was then, at that point, his duty to, I believe, call those witnesses. He certainly had them available. He knew what they would say. He knew that they would exonerate Maurice Coleman.
Let me ask you this. Is there any evidence suggesting that Arlander Adamson would have reason to falsely identify Coleman as the offender?
Judge, I don't believe the record reveals any reason why Arlander Adamson would have said it was Maurice Coleman. There is evidence that Gwen Thomas, who had apparently a romantic relationship with Roy Wright, who was later identified by Joseph Barnes as his co-defendant who committed this crime, there is reason to think that she might want to protect him and not reveal him. And we know from Roy Wright's own statements that a lot of what Joseph Barnes said is in fact true, that there was a drug relationship, that he did have a drug relationship with the victim, Terrell Jackson, that they were unhappy about the quality of drugs that were delivered, and that was the motive for the home invasion and the crime. And of course, Roy Wright also knew other certain details, like the supposedly missing medallion that has never been recovered or found, that he later claimed was in the possession of Maurice Coleman, and also the trip to the laundromat, which he also knew about. So Roy Wright knew a lot of the details of the crime, even though he supposedly was not involved in the crime, according to him, but was, in fact, the person who was involved in the crime, according to Joseph Barnes. And I think it's the failure to call the Wilkins brothers and the failure to secure the severance, which, of course, we allege constitute ineffective assistance, also demonstrates petitioner's innocence, actual innocence of this crime. Finally, there was the Cady testimony of the two, Evelyn and Loretta Cady. And the Cadys were alibi witnesses who said that they were with the petitioner at the time of the murder. Neither of them were called at the trial.
Is there any evidence from the time of the trial corroborating the Cadys' willingness to provide Coleman with an alibi defense?
There is evidence, and specifically in the list of witnesses that was provided by trial counsel, the two Cadys were identified as persons who were going to be or likely to be called at trial. And so during the voir dire and the selection of the jury was informed of them in case any of them might have known the Cadys. And so trial counsel was aware of the Cadys and was aware of their testimony, but did not call either of them in this case. And the last thing I would say, because it is obviously a relevant consideration under House versus Bell, is the strength of the state's case. That is something that the court has to consider. And in that score, there isn't anything in the state's case that, independent of the two witnesses, Gwen Thomas and Mr. Adamson, which supports the defendant's guilt, the petitioner's guilt. There isn't any statement of the petitioner that was offered or introduced. There wasn't any motive, that is to say, the motive of the crime was the drug deal gone bad, and there isn't any evidence that the petitioner was involved in drug dealing with Joseph Barnes. There wasn't any forensic evidence, no fingerprints, no...
Well, there's no indication, though, that those two eyewitnesses, at least if we accept your thing, were just mistaken. They had no motive to identify him.
Well, I think Gwen Thomas may have had a motive because she had a romantic relationship with Roy Wright. And if you accept that Joseph Barnes' testimony that Roy Wright was involved, she may have had a reason not to want to implicate her boyfriend. Perhaps Arlander Adamson derivatively would have had that same concern, but at that point we don't know whether they ever had a conversation or anything like that. There isn't any direct evidence in the record that would suggest that Mr. Adamson was fabricating that Maurice Coleman was involved, although there is evidence that his identifications might have been shaky and not correct, not even including the evidence of the Wilkinsons and the Cadys and Joseph Barnes, but just simply because of the whole circumstances of it, that he had his head down all the time, he didn't observe a lot of what was happening, he was unable to describe what exactly Maurice Coleman did. He could say that Joseph Barnes was basically the leader of the invasion, who came in and put the gun to his head, and but he didn't know who, for example, tied him up. He didn't know who shot Terrell Jackson. He didn't see that. He couldn't identify who did that. He really doesn't describe anything about what it is that petitioner did in the commission of this offense, other than he was one of the two people. Yes, I recognize him from the lineup as one of the two people. In light of that demonstration of evidence, I believe that he has more than adequately met the standard he needs to meet in order for this court to assess the substantive claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And indeed, on those claims, again, I think it was clearly deficient performance of counsel not to call the Wilkinsons brothers. He knew of their testimony. He knew the power of that exculpatory testimony, and he simply failed to secure it. He knew about the Cadys' alibi defense. in a case of such slight evidence that depended wholly on this identification of these two witnesses, he really had, there was no reasonable strategic reason not to secure that testimony. I'd like to, unless there are any other questions, I'd like to reserve with the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Marr.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Drew Meyer of the Illinois Attorney General's Office, and I represent the appellee, Warden Ramos. Petitioner is not entitled to habeas relief. His ineffective assistance of counsel claim is procedurally defaulted. He presents no meritorious evidence to support his actual innocence claim, which would provide him a gateway to reach his ineffective assistance claim. And even if he could pass through that gateway, his ineffective assistance claim is meritless. First of all, I'd like to highlight, because we didn't get a chance to in our briefs, the evidence with which the district court supplemented the record in recent weeks. The kernel of this evidence are two letters that petitioner himself attached to a post-conviction petition that he filed in state court 41 days before counsel filed the habeas petition on which this case is being litigated, in which petitioner's counsel on direct appeal, Patricia Unson, informs petitioner that she spoke to petitioner's trial counsel, and petitioner's trial counsel explained that he didn't call the Wilkins brothers because the Wilkins brothers hedged or equivocated as to whether they could say that petitioner was not one of the men they saw around the victim's house around the time of the crime. Not only that, Cull explained that he didn't call the Wilkins brothers because their testimony was more dangerous if exposed to cross-examination than it was worth. And it's particularly appropriate to consider this evidence in an actual innocence claim where the court has to take into consideration the total record and all evidence available to determine whether this actual innocence claim, which requires a very, very compelling showing on the part of the petitioner, should succeed. Discussing petitioner's actual innocence claim, House and Schlupp require that petitioner present, carry a burden, and to present new, reliable evidence such that, as part of the total record, they make it more likely than not that there is no reasonable juror who would have found petitioner guilty. And petitioner's evidence is either not new, not reliable, or both. First of all, the Wilkins evidence. The exculpatory component thereof is not new. It was adduced through the cross-examination of Detective James O'Leary at the trial, the fact that David Wilkins saw two men on the back porch of defendants of the victim's house and could not identify petitioner as one of them in a lineup. That information was entered into evidence, and it was emphasized by petitioner's counsel on closing argument. So it's not new, nor is it reliable. The letters with which the district court supplemented the record show that petitioner's counsel knew that the Wilkins brothers equivocated or hedged as to whether they could truly state that petitioner was not one of the men they saw at the victim's house. And it should be noted that the Wilkins evidence upon which petitioner relies is merely hearsay preserved in a note written by petitioner's counsel. It was not tested by cross-examination. We have no idea regarding the conditions under which these witnesses claim to have seen these two men around the victim's house, and its probative value is correspondingly slight.
Let's move to the Barnes affidavit and what Barnes claimed during the affidavit and also at the post-conviction hearing, and get to this whole issue of the co-defendants and the...
Absolutely, Your Honor. Well, as you point out, petitioner's both his actual innocence claim and his actual innocence claim, I should say, rests heavily on on his co-defendant's testimony. Joseph Barnes has repeatedly perjured himself or suborned the perjury of others. His credibility is worn to a tiny nub. And more than that, the post-conviction court, who heard both Barnes and his attorney Rhodes testify live, determined that Joseph Barnes had no credibility and that his account of the event was unbelievable. He found that Barnes' testimony was motivated by his friendship and gang affiliation with petitioner, and that gang affiliation is supported in the record. Barnes affiliated with Cobra Stones in prison, and that's the same branch of the same organization as the Mickey Cobras, to which petitioner belongs. And the court that heard Barnes testify also found that Barnes was, in fabricating this new account, motivated by a desire for revenge against Roy Wright. Roy Wright was, as Barnes knew, the man who connected him to the crime, and it led to his arrest that led to his life sentence. So as the court found, both the trial court that heard this testimony and the Illinois appellate court, Barnes' testimony so lacks credibility that the outcome of the trial would have been no different. Regarding the credibility determination by the post-conviction court that heard this testimony, it's established that the trial court who hears testimony is in the best position to determine the credibility of the witnesses. House does allow for the habeas court to make new credibility determinations in light of new evidence, if that evidence so requires, in the words of House. But here, the only evidence that has emerged since that 1995 evidentiary hearing at which Barnes testified are the 1999 and 2000 Cade affidavits, which are neither reliable enough or sufficiently related to Barnes' testimony to warrant a revisitation of a credibility determination.
Let's go back to Barnes for a minute, because Coleman's lawyer, of course, owed no duty to the co-defendant. And what trial strategy, aside from supporting the co-defendant, can we presume was the basis for Coleman's counsel's sealed motion for severance and not calling, you know, not trying to put in that statement of Barnes or calling Barnes?
I beg your pardon. Absolutely, Your Honor. The decision not to use the Wilkins evidence to support the motion for severance was entirely reasonable when you consider that, other than the Wilkins, as we now know, very equivocal ability to say that one of the two men they saw that day around petitioner's house was not petitioner, again, equivocal, so of relatively slight value to petitioner's case. But on every other point, the Wilkins accounts corroborated the accounts of the state witnesses, including, most significantly, their identification of Joseph Barnes as one of the men they saw. Petitioner's counsel's strategy at trial was to create reasonable doubt by attacking the ability of the state's witnesses to observe their attackers and to identify them later. And by confirming that the state witnesses correctly identified one of their assailants, the Wilkins brothers' testimony would have dispelled any reasonable doubt as to those witnesses' ability to see their attackers, which would have dealt a severe blow to petitioner's case. So in this case, as petitioner admits, there is no evidence that the state knew that the Wilkins brothers could positively unequivocally identify Joseph Barnes. So because that evidence was so corroborative of the state witnesses and so enhanced the state witnesses' credibility, it was entirely reasonable for petitioner's counsel not to reveal that information in support of his motion for severance, because if severance was denied despite revelation of that information, the Wilkins brothers' information, a host of negative effects would have followed. He would have been tied to a doomed co-defendant who had been identified both by the state witnesses and by the Wilkins brothers, and the general credibility of those state witnesses would have been significantly enhanced. So in response to your question, that is why this is an entirely reasonable decision. And, Your Honor, I should add that the only evidence in the record that casts any light on petitioner's trial counsel's decision-making process is the supplementary evidence with which the district court just supplemented the record, which reveals that Cull did not call the Wilkins brothers because they equivocated as to whether they could state petitioner was not one of the people they saw around the victim's house at the time of the crime. And in the absence of any other evidence regarding his decision-making process, as this court has held in Johnson v. Loftus, and as the Supreme Court stated in Strickland, the court must assume or presume, the court must presume that petitioner's trial counsel's decisions were made in the exercise of reasonable professional judgment. Your Honor, just to briefly address the Cade affidavits bear the taint of familial bias, which this court has warned about in Hayes and the Supreme Court has warned about in House, and are consequently of little value, probative value, that is. These affidavits emerged 17 years after the crime, and as this court held in Schlupp, a court should consider the time between the time that it takes for affidavit testimony to emerge and the reliability of those affiants before it credits any affidavit testimony or alibi testimony, and the Cade affidavits are therefore of little or no probative value. So because the Cade evidence and the Wilkins evidence is so weak, petitioner is left to rely on the word of his serial perjurer co-defendant, Joseph Barnes. The petitioner just admitted here at this podium that Joseph Barnes' testimony, combined with his attorney's repeating his what Joseph Barnes says, is insufficient to carry his heavy burden under House and Schlupp, and we agree. So, to repeat, the evidence that petitioner, the new evidence that petitioner presents is either not new or not reliable or both, and therefore his actual innocence claim fails. And for the reasons we've discussed, Your Honor, his underlying ineffective assistance claim is also meritless. So if the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Show bad, I have about 1 minute.
Two very brief things, Your Honors. First of all, with respect to the supplemental record, that matter, as I indicated in the motion to strike, was never presented to any judge that has reviewed any of these claims. And so I don't believe it should ever be part of the record. But the contemporaneous record, the record that was put under seal by trial lawyer Gary Cull, is not the same as the recollection that is contained in these letters. And I know that the state says, well, gee, it's hearsay. Well, those letters are at least triple hearsay, and we don't even know if they're authentic because no one has even verified that those are, in fact, letters that were written by Patricia Unson to Maurice Coleman, or that they accurately reflect any conversation that she may or may not have had with trial lawyer Gary Cull. But what we do have in the record was the statement made at that time under seal in which trial counsel said, these two Wilkins brothers unequivocally will say it was not petitioner who was involved in this offense. That's what the record says at the time. And the last thing I would say is the state opposed an evidentiary hearing in this case in which they could have called, I could have called, the court could have assessed the credibility of all of these witnesses from Joseph Barnes to the Cadys to a trial counsel. They opposed that motion and therefore And the district court denied us the hearing, and so therefore the district court did not consider these things. Their speculation about trial strategy is just purely that, speculation. And as I noted in my reply brief, if they're right that was reasonable trial strategy, then I don't know what counsel is supposed to do. If counsel was presented, for example, with forensic evidence, a video showing Barnes going into the house but not Coleman, under their theory, that shouldn't be put on either because it would show that it really was Barnes, which would corroborate their witnesses, even as it was simultaneously showing it could not possibly be Coleman. So I really, quite frankly, don't understand that argument at all. Thank you, Your Honors.
Sure, about you took this case by way of appointment?
I did.
You have the thanks of the court for your vigorous representation of your client.